Mark Schwain this morning did a helpful kind of session on the nature of Christian action, how to judge it, the kinds of problems raised even by using the words together, Christian action, question of whether you judge an action by the agent, by the action itself, by the consequences of the action, or by the motivation. Vern Faieta is talking about prophecy and the kind of heat laid on Isaiah by the Lord, and what it was that Isaiah had to go through to figure out what the Lord wanted him to do. John, obviously, with his Politics of Jesus group, is exploring Yoder's notion of the model of Jesus as a person separate from the political concerns of his day, deeply involved in them. And it seems then fairly appropriate that we surface, as has been surfaced in the past few months here at Holden this summer, the topic of corporations. A couple of opening comments just to set our frame. It is clear that when we're talking about corporations, we are talking about the dominant institution in American culture. There can be absolutely no doubt about that. This is a corporate culture. When we, in my town, Chicago, when we have new students in from the cornfields and we're introducing them to the feel and shape of city life, one of the first things we do is to take them down to Chicago's Loop. And there on Dearborn Street is a series of buildings. And we ask them to look at those for a while and to think about them. And what becomes clear after a while is that you see the whole history of the dominant institutions of cities spelled out on that street. The smallest building on that street is a temple. After the temple are a number of medium height structures, which are governmental offices, and then towering over the entire stretch of Dearborn Street in the Loop of Chicago is the First National Bank. By their architecture shall ye know them. Cities obviously used to be organized around either the governmental structures or the temples. We should point out at the beginning, too, so that we don't get off on too many tracks, although it's going to be hard to focus this discussion, that the context for our discussion is constantly shifting and immensely complicated. We are not in the world now when we can talk about with any kind of helpfulness at all, a kind of Adam Smith laissez-faire capitalism. If there's anybody in the room who thinks that that's the way the economy has operated in this country for the last 80 years, be disabused. Clearly, we have something else in front of us. Clearly, too, we are not dealing with anything at least purely representative of something that we might call a welfare state, or certainly not anything close to socialism. We're dealing, let me suggest at the outset, with a complexly mixed economic system, the best kind of label to put on it that I know of these days has to be a series of words, each of which describes part of the elements of that system that we all live in. So something like state capitalism, or from some points of view, monopoly state capitalism, seems to me to be the kind of descriptive series of words that we have to use in order to begin to understand the nature of the beast we're dealing with here. The issues are unlimited. I think when we talk about corporations, we are probably talking not about that still close to 40 or 50% of the economy anchored in small businesses or small firms. We are talking about that more than half of the economy concentrated in the 1,000 or 1,500 largest business enterprises in the U.S., each of which has a very complex relationship with various kinds of state structures. So I think our focus is on the biggies. Our focus is on their operation, how we come at that from what we think about as Christians, how we act in relationship to them. My own interests particularly are corporations as they impact upon cities, but I'll talk some more about that maybe in the next couple of days, and as they impact upon certain foreign policy areas, particularly at this point, Southern Africa. There are some models before us these days about of Christians seeking to address themselves to the area of corporate responsibility. And I wonder if I might just impose upon Dave Brown to share just a minute or two of an outfit that he is involved with, which is one kind of model for Christian involvement in the area of corporate responsibility. Dave is not only the newly elected bishop of the Iowa district, which I think makes him a corporate leader, but also has recently taken on the appointment to the board of the Interchurch Council on Corporate Responsibility. And I wonder, Dave, if you could just talk a little bit about how that group addresses this question to lead us into some stuff.
Okay. First of all, can I just mention something that's just kind of really off the press, which I've had a chance to glance at while coming out on the train here, called Lobbying the Corporation by David Vogel. It's a basic books thing, and the first attempt to document what has been happening in the last 10 years. It really is only 10 years ago that this whole thing, whatever it really is, it isn't a movement, I don't think, began. And, you know, for the previous 60 years, there was absolutely no calling into question of what the policies, even the potential fiduciary policies of the corporations were. They had absentee board directors. Management became the thing that was characteristic of the corporation. I've been on the board of directors the last year or so of an outfit called the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, which in a way is a culmination of a lot of things that went before it. There have been a lot of organizations. It started out with some challenge to, by minority groups in corporations trying to get more employment. They would use the proxy resolution to do that. There were labor unions who were also, we had large pension funds that were beginning to do this. It's interesting, I think, that the church, when it became interested in this, really went into the international field, and it's pretty much characterized since its work started by that kind of concern, and I suppose that's somewhat natural, since the church is an international kind of thing. But the two areas which, you know, you've heard the most about, surely, are the trying to reach corporations in the matter of investment policies in South Africa, which includes Namibia and Rhodesia and the like. That has a whole range of resolutions, from stopping all investment to seizing more investment to very mild kinds of resolutions. The Interfaith Center of Corporate Responsibility is made up of mainline Protestant groups, plus, I'd say about 30, 35 quarters of the Catholic Church. And so it's a very diverse group, representative of very kinds of oranges and apples in some ways. But the staff, which is small, is very competent. They do not act, I think, irresponsibly. They have done their homework very carefully. In more cases than not, they have met with the corporate structures, the managers mainly, and they have withdrawn the resolution because they have reached a satisfactory point before it took place. So in addition to South Africa and all of that business, The other one, of course, that you've probably heard more about is the companies that have been pushing, and I mean really pushing, the use of bottles for babies over against the breast. They've had big campaigns, not to get into a lot of it, but I've seen billboards that say, you know, bottled babies are better fed than breastfed babies. This kind of thing is all over. They address people who have no skills or competency in nurses' uniforms and send them out in the villages. They give hospitals and doctors supplies to the point where the mother's milk dries up and then she is stuck with a very expensive formula that she usually can't handle because she hasn't got the hygienic tools to help her there, or it's too expensive so she dilutes it in the baby. And you know, it's proven that all kinds of children have died because of this practice. And I would say the Interfaith Center of Corporate Responsibility has made most of the American companies come to heel here and made them realize that they are wrong and that they didn't realize what they were doing, what they were getting into. But there is one company which is very difficult to touch, and that happens to be the Nestle company because it's a Swiss corporation. So the battle goes on there. They have been operating with impunity around the world. I just came from a meeting just very recently where they had gotten all kinds of documentation that the Nestle company, for instance, is still carrying on these same practices, even though it denies it. Well, you can see it printed in the Des Moines Register or almost every newspaper in America. At the recent meeting of the Presbyterian USA and Presbyterian US, a resolution was there to boycott Nestle products. They sent six of their representatives there. Claimed that they were no longer doing this kind of things. The documentation, of course, was in the hands of the people who were leading that resolution, and it was passed. The American Lutheran Church, I'm chagrined to say, is the only church in America that has not successfully passed a boycott resolution. Well, there are many, many other things. As you suggested, is extremely complicated.
Okay, that's all the introduction you're going to get. The floor is open, the fireplace is open, toss it out. Where do you want to take it? Y'all deal with corporations, right? Some of us probably work for them.
Some of us probably own them.
All right.
Along that line, Peter Drucker had an interesting article where he made the point that over, I think my numbers are right, over 50% of corporate stock is owned by pension funds. And so in a sense, he argued, sort of a twist, that we now have socialism in the United States because the workers own the majority of the stock. I don't know how to evaluate that or what it means. But we all own them, mainly through our pension plan.
I think you need to, first of all, separate the corporate form from management. The corporate form in itself is not bad. The church is a corporate form. And the word
you're using the church as an example of the good? I just want to make sure that we get that on the table, if that's what you want to do with it.
I'm sorry.
You were using the church as an example of the good. There.
I'm just saying that corporate form.
Yeah.
Is not in itself bad. Okay. In fact, there's more to be said for corporate form than for proprietorship, which is individual ownership. Mm-hmm. The corporate form is under a much more rigorous legislative control. For all practical purposes, the proprietorship only has to abide with the same laws that any other citizen has to abide with. But the corporate form is required to abide by the state laws of corporation, as well as the most of those established interstate commerce. So the corporate form itself is not bad. Management may be bad. Management are people. If you go back into the history, the behemoths of our industrial society were family ownerships. And we had some rather nasty experiences with some of the very large wealthy families of this country, who in some textbooks are made to be heroes and others are made to be monsters, depending on your point of view. But I get very irritated when people, you know, use corporate as a nasty word. And I don't believe corporate in itself means that it has to be bad. Largeness in itself doesn't have to be bad. We've strived for years to try and increase the size of the church. So if you were to say largeness is bad, then we're headed in the wrong direction. And there is some problems with largeness, but that doesn't make largeness bad.
Yes.
Can we just assume that a corporation is an it and it has no nothing, it's just an if, it's a legal structure, and we can go from there.
Okay.
If we're going to talk to a corporation, we can't get too far with talking to the legal structure, can we?
Say some more.
Well, I say we can't, can we? I mean, it's an it. It's a, it has no, it, we can't endow it with conscience or anything. It's just a legal structure. So if you're going to do something to it, you're going to have to change the law or change its structure legally, supposedly, or you're going to have to deal with the people involved. Mm-hmm. So we get back to a people problem, don't we?
Okay, Warren?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is an important point, that it's easy to blame, quote, the corporation, you know, but the corporation, in a sense, just like the United States, is made up of people, and a lot of us are involved in corporations. So that the evils of the corporation, in a real sense, are caused by, you know, our own, you might call it sinful nature, you know, our greed. We want to maximize our own income for our own personal needs, whatever it might be. If we buy stock, we buy stock in a corporation that's successful. A corporation is set up in this system to maximize profits. And if a corporation doesn't do that, they don't sell stock, you know. And we don't buy stock in it. So I think that, you know, the ills of the corporation are reflected in our own greed. Even the Nestle Company, you know, they, I'm sure they're, whether they, I don't think they had intent, now I really don't know, but I would guess they didn't have intent to go over to Africa and do the destruction and the evil that has taken place. But they were interested in maximizing profits. Now hopefully, you know, and it's disturbing to hear that after they're shown what's happening, that they don't change their ways. I think this is a serious issue then. But any corporation is there to maximize a profit, which, you know, we want them to do. Unless we can curb our own greed, well then the corporation isn't going to curb its greed.
We're surfacing defenders without having surfaced an attack too much. Yes. Yes.
One of the places that corporations came in for quite a lambasting was at the World Council of Churches Conference on Faith, Science, and the Future last month at MIT, where repeatedly third world speakers used multinational corporations as somewhat the embodiment of evil as far as the effects which they personally felt from the activities of these organizations, which I would gather would include not only the specific examples given today, but things like the cultivation of cash crops for export, like coffee, tea, chocolate, rather than food for the people of the nation, the removal of natural resources, minerals, fuels, and so forth for the benefit primarily of people like us rather than the people of the nation. They did say that the activities of the state corporations from the Eastern European socialist countries, is the phraseology used there, they found indistinguishable from the multinational corporation. But as I sat there listening, I could not come up with any suggestion of what else is there. What other kind of structure to operate a society which might in fact be of benefit to the material well-being of people who desperately need that to be improved.
Yes. I think we formed our government for that, didn't we? But it seems to have gotten out of hand. Isn't that what our government was supposed to do for us?
Say some more, you're being cryptic.
Well, I mean, way back when we set up our government, wasn't it to do these things for us, for the common good of the people involved? I think the third world, their government should do that. These corporations are not designed to run their country for them. I think their government is the place that at least that's the way we started out, and we've gotten along pretty well for a couple hundred years.
Part of the problem that they see is not only their government, but our government or any other government cannot handle the situation because they transcend governments as multinational entities. He mentioned the difficulty of people in the United States effectively dealing with the Swiss corporation. People in Africa, their government may be even less able to deal with these external entities which have come in, and there is no supranational government to do the job you speak of on the supranational corporation.
What do you think OPEC did? They seem to be doing a pretty good job to these supranational corporations.
In that one example, which hasn't yet been emulated in any other field,
well,
may be coming.
It sure can. When you have the only source of a certain mineral that is needed for the rest of the world, I think you can do a pretty good job if you try.
Right now, I'm involved in I consider it a personal struggle against the large corporations that seem to think that manufacturing garbage is what they should do and what we should pay them to do. And somehow, we aren't able to convince large numbers of large corporations not to give a lot of money. So it's a financial problem when the citizens try to band together to do something for themselves. They don't have any bucks, but boy, those guys have really got the money. I'm not kidding you. I'm talking about a bottle bill for the state of Washington. And I read all the stuff about what happened in Massachusetts, and their governor vetoed it after he'd gone through the legislature and they passed it. And here, we just sat on our seats and we lobbied like crazy, but man, you should have seen what they did. They had 10 times the lobbyists right there in the state, and we couldn't even, I just feel totally helpless against organizations that can get together enough people to give $10,000 at a whack. I mean, that's just, peanuts. $10,000, $22,000 from one corporation. We got $250,000 already against the bottle bill in this state. And the election isn't even until November. I mean, it just boggles my mind. How can you win? How can you ever win against that kind of money? They just buy their way wherever they go.
Wait till they vote. Count
who
the
are they buying?
Well, one of the things that I think they're truly, truly doing that I think it keeps coming out, and I think they lie flat out. I'm not kidding you. I think they lie, and the consumer believes it because they feel like, if somebody says you're going to lose your job, and they believe it, even if it's not true, they'll believe it. And so they just lie because they make money on those bottles. I mean, they make lots of money on it.
Just tell us something about the bill. Specific.
Well, it's designed like Oregon's. It gets rid of pull tabs and all that stuff, and it's not a two-tiered bottle bill. It's everything would be worth a nickel. I mean, man, when I was a little kid, and I'm 42, we got a nickel for a bottle. I mean, that blows us away. We went down to the hearings, and people would get up and say, a nickel for a bottle? My gosh, they ought to be worth at least 20 cents by now, and the big ones for 50 if you go for inflation. But we find out things from people that worked for the companies. One man in research for Rainier said that they pay now 11 cents for a can. They pay, that's what the guy pays that puts the beer in that can. He also said that some of the bottles that are coming back around for recycling, and they do some of that, they have machinery to do it, it's called a soaker, they've got bottles that have been running through since 1930, and they're still running through. He said, we have tests done that 300 times the bottles can be washed. It seems to me that there's some energy savings and some material savings to be had that are just so very obvious. I don't know why they can buy their way. I don't know how they do it. They do it in large ad campaigns, I know that. Ask? Okay, I'm asking.
Well, they say, how did
they get it?
How do they go through Oregon?
Tell them how they got it.
They got the same people in Oregon you're fighting in the state of Washington.
How did they get it?
Okay, one of the things they had in Oregon was not as many people. Now, I'm serious. They don't have as many people down in Oregon, and they don't have as many big places like Spokane and Tacoma and Seattle and the Tri-Cities. Those are large areas. All they've got in Oregon really that's big is Portland. And Eugene, yeah, is pretty good size, but
I don't quite understand. It's a boat of people. What do you have, 100 people?
That's right. But last time we went through this, in 1970, it was a 49-51 vote in this state, and there weren't any other bottle bills at all. But why do they need to spend $250,000 to give us something that, you know, it's pretty obvious if you went out and collected the signatures on the initiative that the people would like to have in this state. I mean, they would like to have it.
Well, yeah, but they have a chance. We have a chance to vote for it. And I would hope that we would.
No, because they buy your vote.
Well, no, they don't. Yep. They don't buy my vote.
Okay, let me tell you how they buy your vote. Right now, there are grocery bags in the state of Washington that are put out by the Anti-Initiative 61, which is the initiative number. And they say, the Model Litter Control and Recycling Act works. And the people that are responsible for that have declared that they are against Initiative 61, and somehow, of course, through the grocer, there's your big group of grocers that you've given $10,000 so far, they've gotten together, and little grocers too, and they've spent $10,000, and nobody seems to be able to find out how they're getting this on all these grocery bags, but our local
They print
stores,
them on there.
Yeah, they put them on there.
Weyerhaeuser gets paid to do that.
Yeah, but they came from Willamette, too. They were printed down there.
Grocery bags.
All those Oregonians.
Traitors. Lots of legal grocery bags. But I consider that deceptive advertising, because for whom does the Model Litter Control Act work? They didn't even have any decent statistics when they put that law into effect. They don't even know if it really does work or not. I can tell you, it sure is a mess in this state, and it's worse than it used to be. So
this is a cautionary tale about the difficulty of having citizen impact on corporate behavior. Are there any cautionary tales in the other direction? Have people, anybody here, succeeded in influencing or changing the behavior of a corporation in any way? Jim?
Not personally, but look at the Chrysler Motor Company, which is likely to go broke because the people aren't going to buy their cars.
Okay.
It wasn't a campaign, but they do respond to the inability to sell something.
I think too, the whole advent of the small automobile. I remember maybe 5-6 years ago, we had a discussion on energy up here, and Rudy Edmond kept saying that, you know, it's not the corporation that's forcing the big car on you. You know, if you buy the big car, they'll put it out. And he kept saying, as soon as the people start buying a small car, you know, that's when the corporations are going to start producing them. And that's exactly what's happened, you know. So I really, you know, think that
that, you know, we, I think we blame the corporation so often for our own, you know, wrong attitudes.
But sometimes we don't even know that we have a wrong attitude.
Well, you have to dig out the information.
And it takes money.
Well, not for you personally to read.
Yeah, but who's going to print it? Who's
okay.
going to print it?
Yeah, Dave? Get well, some publicity. Get on TV. You know, you've got a story
money.
To tell.
You know what it costs?
You've got a story to tell. The news media, they'll listen to you.
Yeah.
Dave, go ahead.
Well, I just was speaking to the point that the, you know, this last couple of 3 months, we've seen the phenomenon of 50% of the cars that are sold in America are Ford built. That doesn't sound to me like, you know, the American companies have got a message yet. I don't know.
GM, I think, what was it, $2 billion to restructure their, to redesign their, to design their small cars, their 2-liter and 2.8-liter 4 and 6 cylinders.
The message is obviously there when you see Lincoln's being advertised and you can have a Bobcat for $1. If you buy a Lincoln, you know, they aren't moving.
Good point.
I think that there's an intermediate step in the automakers responding to the energy situation in the small cars, and that is the federal law, which requires an increase in steps laid out numerically in the law year by year of the average mileage. And if they don't sell enough of this lower, of the high mileage cars, then they can't sell the bigger cars that they make the bigger profits on to average in with that. And it was only when after the law was passed, as far as I could see, that the listening really began.
I think we're concerned about the methods of getting to the corporation, and obviously one is to not buy the products, but it's very difficult to coordinate an effort. I think, at least in theory and sometimes in practice, we look to our legal or law representatives, the legislature or Congress, to enact the necessary legislation. Yeah. In the design of this country, that was the way in which the people were supposed to accomplish those things that they desired to accomplish, hopefully in a majority form, but sometimes not. I did want to ask a question. When you said measure 61, does that mean there are at least 61 measures, initiatives before the state of the people of the state of Washington?
No.
Well, you must number them different, but in California, the last election, we had, I believe, 34 initiatives brought before the electorate, and the difficulty that I see is that the legislature is taking a do-nothing attitude in Sacramento, which is where I'm from. We refer to them primarily as the drinking bunch. But since there's hardly a week goes by, one of them isn't picked up for 502, which is drunk driving in Sacramento. At any rate, the feel I have in government is that the legislature is not being brought to task in that the initiative process is being used extensively, at least in the state of California, to accomplish something. Prop 13 was our big star in the sky, but there were 34 other propositions on that very same ballot, or 33 other propositions. And I find that very discouraging that you can no longer get your elected representative to do the job that you'd like them to do, and it falls back to some group to create an initiative to get some action done.
Question of the effectiveness of representative government.
Yeah, the obvious solution is to attempt to bring more pressure upon your elected officials. And we all recognize that there is a very influential, wealthy lobby that puts the bill, but there's one thing that a lobby can't do. The lobbyist is only entitled to one vote, just like I am. And in the voting booth, he and I have equal power. My difficulty, or our difficulty, is obtaining, and this is the lady over here, obtaining sufficient data, information to know which way to vote. But there's one very simple solution. If it isn't going the way you like it, try another band of horses.
I think one of the problems that comes out of the whole corporate picture, and you know, the corporate lobbyist not only is a tremendous force against the legislature, but he also provides a tremendous amount of money, together with labor and certain special interest groups, into the elections. And if you look at the history of elections, you can probably give me a more recent figure, but it's an astronomical percentage of people who win elections are those that have the most money to spend, somewhere around 80-90%. So you have a mechanism there which is ultimately the responsibility of the voter, but it's a very difficult fact to fight.
There's, you know, one of the things that we're talking about here, I think, to a great deal, is the frustration of dealing with something so large and recognition of the fact that our government is not, our representatives are not really responsible. They're responsive to the feelings of the people in many ways. There was an interesting article in the Chicago Tribune in the last couple of months, and I don't know if you might have seen that, Jody. It was about a corporation whose primary business, or a company whose primary business is to predict the social trends in the country. And they had found that their sample communities that they used, they didn't use the big East Coast, Washington area, New York, you know, metropolitan industrialized areas of the country. The sample communities where they watched for social trends in this country were a relatively small city in Florida, one in the state of Washington. I don't remember the specific cities, but they were observing particularly some of the things like environmental impacts, where it started out probably as a city law, a city ordinance. It started on a small local scale and grew, and you didn't see it having an impact in the whole country for maybe 6, 8, 10 years. But that's where they did their predictions of where we're going socially, economically, where the feeling of the people was, to predict where our culture is going in the future. So I think that built a lot of hope for me that we shouldn't give up because it's difficult to face the large corporations. Starting in your local community can be the way it, you know, somebody else sees it and takes it back home with them, and it can mushroom from there.
Well, I have an example. We live in Port Angeles, and we are fighting the oil quarries that Northern Tier wants to put in our town, and that's a conglomerate of corporations. So you're dealing not with one, but with many. And I'm sure the people of Minnesota, or not necessarily Minnesota, but some parts of the Midwest, want us to go ahead and put that in so they can get their oil. And even Seattle, which has all the pull in the legislature, the urban areas, want us to have it because they don't want it any closer to them. And we're dealing with it on the county level that's fighting for all we've got, really, not to have it. But the lobbying, the money that they've spent in Olympia is just unbelievable. And, you know, it looks very hopeless.
What's wrong with an oil pipeline anyway?
Well, I think we believe there are other alternate routes.
Have you gotten the oil in your county?
Have we got oil?
Yeah.
Not a whole lot, but enough.
Enough to take care of you in case you...
We wouldn't get that oil. It wouldn't do us any good at all.
No.
And it would do our locality a lot of damage. But there are existing oil, you know, pipelines that could be hooked into this Northern Tier concept, Trans Mountain and so forth through Canada, that would be much better. And it's oil is a short-term thing. In 20 years, you know, there may not be anyone. So it's, we don't feel that it's what they're putting into it. And all we can do is stall them long enough through courts, through environmental impact things, through every means that we can find, to stall them long enough so it's no longer economically feasible for them to do this. And when it becomes economically, you know, infeasible, they won't want to do it anymore.
That's the Northern Tier. Being from Minnesota, I hope you don't stall it very long. It gets awfully cold there in the winter.
But it doesn't get cold where she is.
Real conflict here, okay. Okay, one at a time here, yes.
I want to ask a question. She may be coming.
How
many people really believe that oil is only going to be available for 20 years?
or 25.
Quick survey?
Yeah, kind of, it's a small percentage.
To the extent that it's used now.
My point is, when I was in the third grade, and I'm probably as old as many here, it was only going to be available for 30 years. You know, and we've been using it far more than they ever dreamed when I was that age. Now, I'm not saying that it won't, but what you really get down to, basically, is you're fighting me, for example, or fighting somebody else that, in a sense, may not be me, that it's only going to be available for 20 years, and you don't want it to come through your back door. And I can understand that, huh? But, you know, I may want not want it tonight. That's the environmentalist problem all over. In one sense, it's okay if it comes through your back door as long as it doesn't come through mine. Somehow we've all got to get to the point where we're going to work as a community of peoples in the world, or we're just not going to make it.
But people have got something in their back door, so we should assume to continue having it, instead of us being another.
Would they move away?
How are you getting your oil now?
Ours comes in, it has been coming in largely from tanker, of course, to Cherry Point, which is near Anacortes.
But some
that's been Indonesian oil. You see, now with the Alaska oil coming in, some of that is still coming into Cherry Point. Some of that will continue to come into Cherry Point, but they can't bring their huge tankers in, which is what they want to do at Port Angeles.
But somebody is carrying a burden in order for you to get oil. Now, you don't want somebody else.
Well,
you
they
don't
will continue to do that. But the oil, there's a pipeline that goes through Canada, and there's a place in Canada that would just as soon take in and connect with this existing pipeline, which would go down to the Midwestern states to feed them. But what they would bring into Port Angeles would not help the state of Washington, Oregon.
It would help the greater community, though.
It would help, yes. But okay. It's already built and already there, most of it. It wouldn't take as long.
Two separate questions here. One is the technical question of whether it's possible to find alternatives.
Yeah,
and most of the time, the people whose ox is being gored in these questions do find feasible alternatives.
It's just
there is also the question of are we not playing some zero-sum games here?
Right.
And I'm afraid that as Americans often we're thinking about one-sum games where everybody wins. And one of the things, I think, interesting things that the environmental crunch has done with us is to begin to see that there are winners and losers. We know that in day-to-day life, maybe, but we somehow don't know that as a nation. Yes.
The power to tax is the power to destroy. Have you ever considered that one?
Another cryptic one. I keep having to go like this. Cryptic.
I mean, the corporation can be taxed to death. And it's a nice thing to help provide your schools with monies.
Great
and
idea.
Well, there's a funny thing about this. This would not help us. This would cost us as a county a lot more money than we could ever get out of them, because the tax base is spread by mileage across the pipeline. We would be the port where it would come in, but every other county would get just as much, you see, tax base as we would, and we would have to put the money forth to provide the fire safety, the additional fire safety there within, I've forgotten how many yards of our only hospital. If they had an explosion, it would damage the only hospital for 80 miles around. And there's a lot of, there's water problems. There's not enough water in the city. There's not enough source of water to provide them with enough electricity. Some of our mills might have to close down, would have to close down because of the air pollution. We would lose industry, and we would not gain any. Okay, unless they were to put in refineries.
I'm sure the case could be made
greater.
I'd just like to mention, as a matter of perspective, I happened over the last few months to have visited places in Hawaii, California, Indiana, and Massachusetts. And in all of those places, gasoline's a whole lot easier to get than it is in Seattle and Tacoma.
I had something I wanted to throw out. Now, we're talking about whether the people in Minnesota freeze in the dark. And we're also talking about the water supply in the city of Tacoma. And that's a very serious thing. It's a large city. And the city of Seattle, one of the routes would put that right through our watershed. If it broke in the middle of the winter, there would be no way they could clean it up, because it would be in our mountains on the other side. And if they put it through one route they discussed, they would take it right across Whidbey Island, one of the most beautiful tourist places in the state, but also one with the very best soil. They sometimes grow two crops a year. Also one with the very best soil. They sometimes grow two crops a year. You know, we're talking about a certain community losing its water supply. A lot of people, we're talking about maybe a lot of people being out of work because they can't farm when they have traditionally farmed there for 150 years. And so the trade-offs are so very serious. Now, in the two kinds of oil that we get the sweet crude, and we have to retool our refineries to get the Alaska crude, but they're pumping it out twice as fast as we could take care of it. We could take care of it in the state of Washington if they would pump it out half as fast as they are, and it would also last from Alaska twice as long if they did that. So, I mean, there are other options, too. We could send it to Japan.
You know. We are.
Not from Alaska yet. That's why
the pipeline terminated where it did.
The reason primarily is because that crude up there is a high sulfur content.
That's right.
And that's not acceptable in most places in the United States.
That's right. So we're dumping our pollution on Japan, and it's cute, isn't it? Yeah.
Rudy?
Point of fact, it is not going to Japan. It cannot go there by law. That's one of the major questions before Congress at the present time. There is a law that says none of it can go to Japan, and none of it is. Point of fact.
Rudy, do you also want to maybe speak to the 20-year question that came up earlier here? 20-year supply of oil question. 20-year supply of oil. There was a debate over whether or not that's an accurate statement.
Well, it's an accurate statement that it will be greatly diminished. Well, we won't be out of oil, no. It'll be greatly diminished. So the problems we have with oil now will be accentuated.
Rudy has a fairly current set of slides with probably more accurate technical data than you got when you were a youngster about the oil supply that maybe you might want to check with him on during the week at some point.
I think this has been a very good example of what we've heard just the last half hour about influencing corporations. And it's easier to influence a corporation than it is to influence your legislator or the government. Try and get something done through Congress or something is way harder. Because a corporation, the people that direct it have to show a profit. They're usually only 12, 15 people. They do listen to what sells. But I think a good example is here is, you know, if we took a vote here, would we rather have the oil dump line in this lady's backyard? And then if it's a yes, then how are we to influence the corporation to build it there? And this comes, you know, it's how we, what priorities. Like the corporation may be getting more messages to build it there than not build it there.
Jim? I was going to put forth a very naive proposition. What is the role of the Christian in influencing corporations or government? And the naive proposition is that power rests with the consumer and the citizen, the real power. That the power that cannot be ignored. But it is difficult to get them together, as the lady explained on the bottom there. But the very naive proposition is that one of our Christian responsibilities is to study, to understand, to struggle with our conscience, and do our buying, our voting, out of love, and all the implications of that. Now, this is very naive, because, as Oren said, it may take 10 years for something to happen. I'd like some reaction to this.
What's wrong with 10 years? That's a reasonable period.
Well, people get impatient.
A lot of damage can be done.
Yes.
But I get excited if it happened over the weekend.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me add another guess I have a totally unbiased position as a management consultant. And it seemed to me that the corporate executives that I know are basically reasonable people. They have responsibilities to run an organization effectively, profitably, and so forth. But I've always been impressed with the men and women that I know who are in power positions when they are confronted with genuine, thoughtful kinds of approaches from the public. They really seem to listen, at least that's been my experience with a small number of corporations. And it seems to me that in addition to the power that we have as a consumer, we also have the opportunity as Christians, I think, to go directly to corporate people and try to make our case. And if we do it in the right kind of a way, in a thoughtful kind of a way, I would be surprised if in most instances we wouldn't be heard. Now, maybe that's a very naive position, I don't know.
I think it's fair to say, isn't it, that most of the so-called proxy resolutions that have gone to corporations that have, social implications to them, which, you first of all have to cross that bridge. You have to say, are corporations socially responsible? Are they? And I think that bridge, in one sense, has been crossed for several because they are smart enough to know that they don't want a lot of bad publicity, for one thing. But I think, you'd have to say that most of the resolutions have either passed, or they've been negotiated in such a way that it's been to the satisfaction of the parties involved. And I guess, I just come back to the fact, I guess what you're trying to make, that if we can do some careful kind of workmanship, and now that is not to say that this is an easy task, or that there's ready capitulation. I mean, there are reasonable people, however, in these places of responsibility, and I don't think we should discount that either.
The statement has been made, it's not what we don't know that bothers us, it's what we think we know that isn't so. And I think
beautifully put.
This fits in with the end of the discussion on the great divorce, the sort of the admission to heaven is the reduction of our illusions, or the loss of them about what we are. And as I watch people that are trying to do good, maybe many of them out of Christian motivation, it is their illusions that get them in trouble. They do. That's why they're not successful. They are successful to the degree they're dealing with reality and are able to make the case. And when they make the case with the corporation on these proxy statements, generally something happens. So you have, I think, part of being Christian action is knowing about reality. It's also having values, knowing what love is, but you've got to know about reality too. Which is very large.
Let me just play devil's advocate for a minute. I think a case can be made, at least in my town, in the corporate structures that I know, that the sorts of positions that have been put forth in the last 20 minutes, that is, a reasonable argument put forward in Christian love, falls either on deaf or powerless ears in the corporate world in downtown Chicago, and that the language that is understood by the corporate world in downtown Chicago is the language of power. And power means the ability to somehow withhold, I suppose, support, or somehow push one's point of view, rather than relying on sweet reason. I mean, it sounds to me like many of you really are arguing that one deals with the principalities and powers. As if one is in the seminar room at the university. And my devil's advocate position, at least, is, and probably maybe my own position, is that is incredibly naive. Rudy.
But following up on what you're saying is that really the church can be very powerful. At this point, I think it is not, because it is not really educating the people of the church. These are very serious matters that we're talking about, and what is the church really doing to provide information and to provide the kind of study that makes it possible for the church member to vote the way he should vote? Because the vote is not compromised unless we just lay down on the task of really becoming informed. And the church has not considered this a major kind of thing to be involved in. This is outside of the church.
I'd like to ask you why you feel these are such strong items for the church.
For the very reason that we've been talking about, that it's important for Christians to be properly informed, and if that isn't a part of the church's work, then that's where I come from. I think it is.
I'm not saying that it's not. I just asked you why. The reason why I asked the question is the most fundamental part of the church is to spread the good news. And how well do we do it, and really how well are we preach that in the sense of really being instructed? Now that's our primary goal. All the rest, really, to me at least, become secondary items or ways maybe of achieving that in part. But really, when I look at my congregation, and I've been working with EO now for the last 3 years, of getting every member in every congregation to evangelize, in a sense, to spread the good news, and I think that we're doing a lousy job of it.
Well, I would only counter that I think we're doing a poor job of educating the people within the church of major social issues and matters. I think you cannot expect to educate 1 hour in the pulpit. There needs to be study groups. There needs to be real digging here to come up with what the truth is. And if we get to the truth, I think there's great hope, and I think there's great power in the church.
Jim?
I'd like to respond across the room. I agree that the major responsibility of the church is to evangelize. But because I have been evangelized, and I have been forgiven, and I am a child of God, then I have a motive to love my fellow man. And if my fellow man has less to eat, and less to wear, and less housing, then I am not loving that person. And so I think because I have this gift, I have to give and to worry about these things. Now, you may disagree, as we do in this room, about how to do it, but I think there is very little question about the necessity, because of the gift that God has given us, to worry about these things.
Mm-hmm. No, I guess, you know, until you started playing the devil's advocate, I certainly wouldn't want to leave the impression that somehow if we just are reasonable people, we sit down and talk these things out. Or that the gospel somehow is a half gospel. You know, I think we've got to think a little bit about the integrity of the gospel in South Africa, where you know, the rank injustice is being done to those people in the name of Christian America, let's say. Mm-hmm. Here's an outfit, the Control Data, who publicly states that their top echelon management are committed Christians, involved in their congregation, extremely evangelical in all other ways. And yet, you know, it's been found out through a lot of digging, that they sent some computers to South Africa, which is now used by the police to control the apartheid settlement there. And you know, what kind of witness do we make to those people? We can sit here very comfortably and talk about EO, but those people, you know, are living day by day by, you know, sheer guts. And here are the tools that we help support to make it possible to control those people. Or Polaroid has, you know, got its stuff over there in order that the pictures can be printed up so that we can keep those people in their place. You don't think that they get a message out of that?
And there is, we have all kinds of problems this way. And I'm really not speaking to it because you know more about it than I do. But the thing that I'm concerned about, if you look at it from the same way, is that when you take a look at the church at large in terms of our total combined body, and I again don't know it, only what I read, huh? So I don't know how good it is, but we as a church body, not, you know, as a total church body in the sense, provide things and monies, etc., which turn up to buy other arms, etc., which was agreed to. A question that we had within the Synod Convention that I was involved with, questioned Dr. Marshall at the time, and he agreed that there were some bad things that happened from some of the things that we as a church did in well-meaning, but that other people's used in that same way. So you can always come to this situation that chose a bad side if you want to, and I'm not a user, but you got to be careful because we can be have a few rocks thrown at us as a church in the same way.
Warner?
And Dave, was it the last ALC National Convention that it was brought up about the pension fund owning stock in corporations serving in South Africa, and the church didn't even vote to give up those stock? I think that's, you know, part of the problem where, you know, I don't even think that the vote should have been taken. It should have been automatic. But here, you know, our own church is still owning stock in those corporations, and then we talk about corporations, you know.
Well, admittedly, it's a pretty complex question, and the resolution, you know, to divest of all of our stocks over there was did not pass, but there were some other alternate routes that were chosen, and part of that was that we were to attend, you know, annual meetings of those corporations and find out exactly where those corporations stood. So far, that I know of, we've attended one and complimented the very company that I just referred to as a church body and hit the press all over the place. You know, and just came out with a fork tongue, you know, that made us look absolutely silly.
But why didn't that resolution pass, I wonder?
Well, the resolution was never put before us to divest.
Oh.
The resolution was put finally that should be, you know, that we should be checking into this much more closely than we have been.
Yes.
I make a motion that we burn all our diamonds in protest tonight. No, I'll start the fire.
Sexist motion. Not only a capitalist motion, but a sexist motion. At the moment we are burning our diamonds, may I suggest a 30-second to 60-second break for those who would like to. Normally we're scheduled to go from about 9 to 10, and please feel free. We will desist discussion for about 45 seconds, and those who would like to go, go.